Tango Tango Papa 2036, June 4th, 2019.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Oklahoma City. So, let's see, how long has it been since the last podcast? Let's see, the last one was May the 16th. So it hasn't, man, what is today? Today's the 4th, so a little over 2 weeks, so that's not too bad. At least it hasn't been a month. So anyway, I am. I've been back at work for a number of days. I've been. Right now, I'm on my way to Temple, Texas. Since I came back to work, I've been out to the Seattle area. So I made it out to the Seattle area, and then now I'm kind of back in the really now the south central part of the country, and not scheduled to go home again until the 19th. So let's see. So kind of what's been going on? Pretty much the same stuff as always. While I was home, let's see, what did I do while I was home? I ended up having to replace, I have a tablet, I have a Samsung tablet that I use, you know, I put it up in the, you know, kind of mount it to the dash of the truck, basically. It's kind of stuck to the, you know, get this mount that suction cups to the windshield, and it sits right on top of the dash, just to the right of the steering wheel, and I use that a lot for navigation purposes. I also listen to a lot, sometimes I'll listen to music, and but I listen to a lot of YouTube, especially like lecture type stuff. There's just wonderful material on YouTube. You know, there's also a lot of garbage, but YouTube is just a repository for a bunch of good stuff as well, and certainly there are a lot of lectures and what have you, and I spend a fair amount of time listening to that kind of stuff, and so I do it with that tablet. So, and I've had that tablet, I don't know, for 2 or 3 years at this point. It was a Samsung Galaxy S2 8-inch tablet, and it was probably my fault. I left the thing, it was easier to kind of leave the thing plugged in quite a bit. And it got to the point where it would get down to about maybe 40-50% battery, and then it might, if I suddenly put a tax or sort of a drain on the speeding up the processor, it would just suddenly shut off arbitrarily, because the voltage in the battery had dropped below a certain threshold, and then it would just turn off. And so I decided, well, I need to maybe I can try replacing the battery, which turned out to kind of be a mistake. So I ordered this battery. It was like $16. It was a battery replacement kit from Amazon. And I found this place at home that replaces phone batteries, you know, and obviously they will work on tablets as well. So I took the tablet in there with the replacement battery, and they were going to charge $40 to replace the battery, but they warned me up front that removing the back on that tablet could, there was a potential to crack the screen, the glass screen. And you can guess what happened. That's exactly what happened. The glass screen cracked. So the guy stopped immediately. He did not replace the battery. They didn't charge me anything, and I ended up sending the battery back since the thing wasn't used. Kind of packaged it back up and sent it back to Amazon and got my money back minus about $4 or $5 for the return shipping. And so then I went to Best Buy and I ended up buying a 10-inch Galaxy Tab A that was $250. And by the way, it was going to be like $240 or $250 for the replacement glass screen for the S2 tablet, which that's ridiculous. So it did not make a bit of sense to replace that. So I just spent $250 and got a new tablet, and pretty happy with it. I'm being very careful about not plugging it in too much. I only plug it in when I need to, and not necessarily even charging it all the way. The battery life on this Galaxy Tab A, it's a 10-inch, it's got like a 6,200 milliamp hour battery. The battery life on it is nothing short of amazing. I can listen to it with, you know, and I'm not leaving the screen on, so there's not much screen on time, and I'm listening to a lot of audio, including the YouTube audio, which is one of the things that's included if you have the so-called YouTube Premium. They give you the ability to turn a screen off on your mobile device and just listen to the audio, and that works perfectly for what I'm using it for. So I can go hours and hours and hours, maybe for two or three days at a time, and then before I even have to think about plugging it in and kind of giving the battery a bit of a recharge. So very happy with the new tablet. So what I'm doing is being very judicious about plugging it in, and since I'm not using too much screen on time, the thing will go several days actually before I have to recharge it, which but I'm being very careful about that. I'm also being more careful. I replaced the battery recently in the MiFi device that I have from Verizon. I was having a problem with the battery swelling up, and again, it was my fault. It was just so easy to leave the thing just plugged in to the into the power, and that's bad for those batteries. I guess they must not have the proper charging circuitry built into them and into the device, and so it. What I'm doing now is leaving the MiFi device unplugged during the daytime and then plugging it in at night, just like I do with my phone. Generally, my phone is unplugged all day, and then unless depending on how much I've used it, and then because I may have to boost it during the middle of the day, you know, kind of plug it in and boost the battery back up. But usually, it'll go all day, and then I simply plug it in at night. So I'm doing the same thing with that Verizon MiFi. And it'll generally last all day long, and then I plug it in at night and go to bed, and then the next morning I unplug everything. So, but another thing that I did while I was home, I think you remember a couple of months ago, I hired somebody to clean my house. And admittedly, it was kind of an expensive thing to get the house cleaned. It was pretty expensive. But the gal did just a fabulous job with it, so I'm very happy with the results with that. And I've, you know, am keeping it clean myself. Not to kind of rehash it too much. Over time, the thing kind of got dirty, you know, because I'm gone a lot. Part of the time my parents were living there, a number of times that's my house has kind of been used as a convenient party house for family get-togethers. And over time I just kind of let the toilets go. There were lots of cobwebs in the ceiling, and and I didn't realize it really on the walls as well. A lot of people may not realize that there, you know, how many cobwebs They're easy to overlook. Cobwebs and dust that collects on your walls. You don't think that about it, but it really does. So after the gal came in and cleaned everything up and got the toilets, particularly the toilets, in great shape, then it's kind of easy for me to keep them in good shape. And the thing with the walls, the easy way to do that is with your walls, in particular, with dust and cobwebs, you go to, they sell them everywhere, the Swiffer dusters, and I've probably talked about them in the past. But you get these Swiffer dusters. If you go to Walmart or Target or someplace like that, or your grocery store, supermarket, they're going to charge about $1 a piece for each one of these things, and they're made out of microfiber, and you've got like a little handle type thing, where you can just sort of like a feather duster type thing, except it's microfiber. But then at Walmart, I purchased this. It's a telescoping thing, and it's not very expensive. Also made, it's a Swiffer product, and it comes with a couple of the Swiffer microfiber dusters, disposable ones that are replaceable. And so this thing's telescopic, and it'll extend out to about 6 feet. And then so you put two of these things on there, one on each side, and it kind of makes a sort of a T shape, if you can imagine it. And then you just wipe that on your walls, and you can scrub your entire walls with it. And if you haven't done that before, be prepared to replace the microfiber Swiffer duster. I would have a quantity of those handy, because if you haven't done that in a while, those things are going to, the microfiber filaments kind of fill up with all the dust and grime and what have you, and the cobwebs. And then you simply pull those off, throw them away, and replace it with another one. Now, like I say, those little things, generally they're going to cost about $1 a piece, but I did go to Sam's Club. I was able to go to Sam's Club, and they had a package of 28 of them, and it ended up reducing the cost of each one of those microfiber dusters by half. So it reduces the price to 50 cents. So what you want to do is periodically, and I'd say at least once a month, just use the telescopic part of that, and just wipe your walls down completely. I mean, there's really no reason why you can't. Just, kind of scrub your walls with it to a certain extent, the entire surface area. And I think, you're going to be surprised at how much stuff that, is particularly dust that collects on your walls. You think, well, how can dust collect on a vertical surface? Well, it does. It's probably because of the, your walls probably have a certain amount of texture to them, as well as probably some sort of a minor electrical charge. So, but that's and it makes a giant difference, because in how clean your house seems to be. You may not realize it. You can look at your wall and you think, well, you might see a cobweb here or there. And it's easy to ignore those. But once you get the thing clean, really clean, then it makes a giant difference in how the overall feel of the house and how clean it is. Of course, you want other things cleaned as well. You want to vacuum your carpet and your floors clean, linoleum floors, whatever. If you have tile floors, you want all that clean, but, and kind of have things orderly and not have a bunch of junk out, kind of occupying any horizontal surface. Get rid of all that, or as much of that as you possibly can, and it makes a big, but clean, keeping those walls clean is a big deal. So anyway, I found that woman via the homeadvisor.com website. So while I was home this last time, there are a bunch of other people that offer services. And so I found, I put in a request basically for someone that would come. And there's this product that I've used in the past called Jomax, J-O-M-A-X. And what it's good for, what it's sold for, is you mix it one-third Gel Max, one-third bleach, one-third water, and you spray it on siding or wooden decks or any kind of, you know, even bricks, concrete. It will work on all kinds of different surfaces. You spray it on there. But now, in my case, I have vinyl siding on my house. Spray it on there and then, you know, kind of wash it off. So, and I've done myself in the past, but I've tried to hire someone to do it. And so I put in the request and somebody called. It was actually a woman that called, you know, and she said, well, I'll be out to do an estimate. And she made it out on the day that she said that she would be there, the day and the time. And, you know, she seemed to agree to do it. She's going to, you know, and the price in this case I thought was reasonable. It was $250 to kind of go over the whole exterior of the house, plus there's a deck on the front of the house and a deck on the back. And so she agreed to do that, but then to my knowledge, so far she hasn't shown up since I've been gone, because once she does the job, she's supposed to text me some pictures and then send me, you know, and then I'll pay her through, there's this app called Venmo, which a lot of people have heard of Venmo and they may have used it, but they may or may not realize that that's actually owned by PayPal, because people say, well, I don't have a PayPal account. You know, they think Venmo is a more modern thing, and it may be, but it's still owned by PayPal. But it's very convenient. You know, it's a super easy way to set up to, you know, actually pay somebody. So, haven't heard from her. So, I'm not going to be home until the 19th, so she still has some time left. If I don't hear from her, then I'll just, put the request in again and hopefully get someone out there to do the job. You know, so we'll wait and see what happens with that. So, today I want to, you know, I've been thinking about the idea of ideological possession. And I'm going to talk about that. And I've also got a comment from Scott, kind of responding to one of Joel's comments, and I think that's actually going to end up tying in nicely to the idea of ideological possession. Now, hopefully that air from the air conditioner isn't too much. Let me, I may have to adjust that, because I don't want it kind of blowing across the microphone, making it kind of unbearable to listen to. So, but you have this idea of ideological possession, or being, you know, people can end up being possessed by ideas. Instead of simply having ideas, people are oftentimes possessed by those ideas. And I think to varying degrees, all of us have probably, to one extent or another, been ideologically possessed to varying degrees. Now, you know, there are plenty of examples of people that are ideologically possessed. Particularly, it can happen on both sides, you know, it can happen with all kinds of ideas. And it can happen on both sides of the political spectrum. That, you know, it seems like politics is where really ideological possession ends up kind of really rearing its ugly head. But you see these the Antifa type leftist protesters are a great example of people that are ideologically possessed, and you know, where they're just kind of screaming, or even in some cases violent. They're exhibiting violence. right in other people's faces. That is, those are great examples of ideological possession. And, you know, but there are lesser examples of it as well. I think that's one of the big problems with trying to have political discussions with people, because if someone is ideologically possessed, then what ends up happening, they'll simply discount, you know, you present them with facts and they simply throw them out. They complete, psychologically, they discount them. And, you know, it doesn't matter to them. Ideologically possessed people often, you know, at the extremes, oftentimes they want to see their ideas sort of forced down everyone's throat, regardless of whether it makes any sense or not. And if this becomes too widespread, if the idea ideological possession ends up becoming too widespread, and to the point where you have people that are sort of not, you know, they're learning not to say anything for fear of upsetting, you know, of triggering the diatribes or even violence from the ideologically possessed people. You know, basically that's kind of like political correctness. Once you have that, if you have that happening too much, and it's kind of a progressive thing, if the tide of that isn't stemmed, then you can end up with a situation like Nazi Germany, where people will kind of begin to deny, they'll begin to sort of go along with the lie. And it gets to the point where that's how you end up with millions of Nazis, for example. And, you know, we would all like to think that, you know, kind of quoting Jordan Peterson, we would all like to think that we would be the, you know, like the Schindlers and you know, stand up against the Nazis. But the brutal reality of it is that that's not the case. Most of us would end up being, if we were in Nazi Germany, we'd be Nazis. You know, and we'd be going right along with it, you know, and thinking it was, you know, and it would be possible that we could twist things in our minds to think that it's actually a right thing to do. Same thing happens on, you know, on the other side of the political spectrum. Same thing happens, you know, in socialist countries. So you have a country like Venezuela, you know, where they've, you know, one of the things that they did, you know, and it's been some time since they did it, they, take care of the starving children problem by, you know, making it illegal for the doctors to say that, the child is ill or the child died because he was starving. You know, make that illegal, that solves the problem. So make the doctor lie, in other words. And that's a form of so-called political correctness. So people begin shutting up so that, you know, they don't trigger the sort of the ideological algorithm that possesses a large, you know, a seemingly large vocal percentage of the population, the populace. So it really is up to us to not allow that to happen, Solzhenitsyn, Andrei Solzhenitsyn, it's really tough to listen to. I think I've mentioned it before on YouTube. There's this, you know, the audiobook version of it, it's called Gulag Archipelago. And Solzhenitsyn, kind of documented these different, they were gulags, or they were concentration camps, basically, that were spread all through the Soviet Union, that, where they were just kind of, it could happen to anybody, they just kind of pick people almost at random sometimes, basically put them in prison, and, for ostensibly no reason. Maybe somebody ratted them out, or maybe someone, people would turn each other in to try to protect themselves. They'd say, oh, no, the neighbor did it. You have to turn, I'm going to turn this person in, or I'm going to denounce them. And then they'd end up, for whatever reason, then they'd end up in this prison, basically. They'd lose their freedom, and they'd be put through all kinds of physical and mental tortures. And, that was rampant in the Soviet Union. And, God knows how many people died in those prison camps. Maybe upwards of 100 million. We don't know. But there were millions of people that died in those. In a lot of cases, they'd simply never regained their freedom, and they'd simply disappear, and that would be the end of it. And, so the same thing was, same type of thing. People were sort of rationalizing in their own minds. They were sort of lying in order to try to maintain the peace, so as not to upset the apple cart. Try to retain whatever, some sense of security. But what Solzhenitsyn said, that all it takes is for one person to simply be honest and not go along with the system, and the whole thing would come tumbling down. And I think there's some validity to that, because Solzhenitsyn himself, he survived, like 20 years worth of the being in, kind of in these gulags, and he ended up, finally, he was able to escape to the West. And he was able to publish the book, The Gulag Archipelago. There's like five parts to it. And that is one of the things that's really credited with bringing the Soviet Union kind of down. And certainly Ronald Reagan helped as well. So that those, the Soviet Union seemed like it was a formidable thing, but it was basically a house of cards. But it relies on, that kind of thing relies on people sort of lying to themselves, sort of falsifying their own identities. The idea of being ideologically possessed, being possessed by an idea, what causes any kind of, and it really is possession. That is the correct term to use. Possession works via the mechanism of resentment. And we're going to go back to that. Resentment is the underlying mechanism that causes possession to, it sort of enables it to take place. It sort of demands that it take place. Because if you resent, and we all end up doing that as human beings, as I've said many times before, we resent our parents. They're typically the people that we first come into contact with. They're resentable because we expect them to, as little kids, you look at your parents and you expect them to kind of be perfect. You expect them to sort of be the representation of what you would think would, kind of the perfect blueprint that we all have. And when I say blueprint, like if you have an idea of a circle, then in your mind that the idea of a circle is perfect. But, the if you draw a circle, you know, then the circle's probably going to have some imperfection in it. So the idea, you know, little kids have the idea of a perfect parent. They sort of know when something is just or unjust. We all kind of have a built-in knowing of what's just and unjust. And parents fail to live up to that. Kids resent the parents. And, you know, sometimes people will say, well, I didn't have a dad. Well, how could I resent my dad? Well, you resent the placeholder not being there. Because, you know, that type of thing. Or you didn't have a mom. Well, you resent the fact that she's not there. You resent the placeholder in your mind. But those are the people we resent. And then, it starts snowballing from there. We end up being socialized. And, of course, the process of being socialized, school and what have you, is kind of a brutal thing, let's be honest. And even though it's a necessary thing, it's kind of a brutal thing. And being put with the other kids and so, et cetera, et cetera. So it goes on, and so we have these resentments. And but at some point, we have to mature. And you have to, you know, kind of put the childish things away. And resentment really is one of those childish things. But people will often kind of hold on to resentment. And resentment is a sin. All who sin are what? Slaves. And a slave is someone that's possessed. So if you want to not be possessed by your ideology, you want to be able to be a whole person. You want to be able to be a complete person. You want to be able to think for yourself, actually, and not simply react in a knee-jerk reaction, in a knee-jerk way. You have to be willing to give up your resentment. And it's not an instant process. It's not something you say, oh, well, I'll just say that I'm going to not have it, and right, I'm going to give it up or whatever, and it's going to go away. It's quite a tenacious thing. So it's not, generally, it's not something that's going to happen overnight. You have to have a willingness. You have to have more than a willingness. You have to really have a desire to really be able to look at yourself. And looking at yourself is kind of a painful thing because, you know, if you're honest, you know how treacherous you can be. If you're really honest with yourself, you know that you can be a jerk. If you're honest, you really know that you can be a liar. And you have been. So, you know, part of becoming a mature person is to face that. Kind of own it. Another one of the Jordan Peterson things that I like that he says is, always tell the truth, or at least, the way he puts it, always tell the truth, or at least don't lie. Every time you tell a lie, you're sort of trading a little piece of your soul for that lie. So you can, and why do you tell lies? So you can look good in other people's eyes. Same thing with, the example that I always like to use is stealing the pen in the bank. You know, because you think no one's looking there. They have the cheap free pens out there, and you think, oh, they're free or whatever, and you just, oh, I'll take that pen. And you have you think you got a big advantage. You got the pen. Well, you traded a little piece of your soul for that stupid pen. Not a very good bargain. Once you start lying to yourself, then, you know, when you do that, you kind of put yourself at odds with your conscience, and then you have to say, well, they expect people to steal those. they're buying their cheap pins. They're expecting people to steal them. You know, and you try to make wrong into right. And that ruins, every time you do that, even if it's just stealing a pin from a bank, a cheap pin from a bank, you're ruining your ability to see the world, to perceive the world, to perceive reality. You're compromising your ability to perceive reality. With every little lie that you tell, every little bad thing that you do, and then you twist it in your mind so that you can, you know, try to, you know, put your conscience at bay. Every time you build a wedge, drive a wedge between yourself and your conscience, you are further damaging your ability to perceive reality. Then, of course, you find other people that will agree with you. Oh, wrong is right. Right is wrong. We're all going to get together and have a march. It's really okay to murder your baby. It's really a noble thing to murder your baby. People that are in favor of abortion are ideologically possessed. They're possessed with the idea. That's kind of a blatant example of ideological possession. So it's really a dangerous thing to lie to yourself. To lie to other people, because you're also lying to yourself. And you're sort of compromising, as I say, you're compromising your ability. Every time you do that, you're compromising your ability to perceive the world accurately. And that's really a bad thing. You're also, not only are you compromising your ability to perceive the world accurately, you are also making yourself that much more miserable. You are creating hell for yourself. Every time you lie, every time you lie, steal, cheat, whatever it is, and you know what you're doing wrong, you have a conscience. Most people do. There's very few people that don't. Most people do. Every time you compromise that, you try to twist things around, you're creating more hell for yourself. But you're also, beyond that, you're also, and this is another Jordan Peterson idea, you're tilting the, every time you do that, just stealing the cheap pin from the bank, you're tilting the world a little bit more towards hell. So one of the ideas that he's kind of talks about occasionally is the idea that, and it's not his idea, but he talks about it, is the idea that each one of us is sort of a center of, you could say, the universe, a center of the world. A center of the existence. each one of us, to a certain extent, is. And so if we do something wrong, and we sort of bend ourselves to end up kind of bending ourselves towards hell, personally, you know, individually, then we're also bending the entire world a little bit more towards hell, creating hell on earth. So conversely, if you go in the opposite direction, you do the right, you see the right thing and you do the right thing, you're moving yourself more towards the heavenly side, and therefore you're moving the world more towards the heavenly side, because we don't exist in a vacuum. Each one of us is, you know, far more influential. We're far more influential than we think. We're far more influential than we generally believe ourselves to give ourselves credit for. Especially, you know, when it comes to the negative thing, you think, oh, it's just me, I'm going to do my negative thing, and I've created my own hell, and I, you know, but it's not so simple. So there's more to it than simply, well, I'm going to do good because I'm going to, you know, I'm going to chalk up brownie points for the afterlife. That's not it. That's not the reason to do the right thing. That's not the reason to do, you know, to think of these more, you know, kind of struggle with these moral dilemmas. That's not the reason, you know, because you think you're amassing brownie points for the afterlife. It doesn't work that way. You're making yourself either, you're creating heaven or hell for yourself right here, right now. Another Jordan Peterson, or, you know, an idea that he's talked about is, we are not, you know, you may think of yourself, well, I'm just here in this moment. And it's useful to realize that you're in the moment. It's useful to, you know, kind of realize that you're in the moment. But you also have to realize that there's a future version of you. You know, you have a past version, but there's also a future version. Now, if you make the wrong choices, you know, because one of the things we do, we sort of bargain as human beings. We're able to sort of bargain, make a bargain, you know, sacrifice something now so that we can have something for the future. You know, if we just sort of live for the moment, as it were, then, you know, the hell with the future. Well, if you just screwed the hell out of future you, you know, because present you, you know, wanted to grab the gusto. So you're much, much better off, you know, kind of telling the truth, doing the right thing. As I say, you know, most of us have, the vast majority of us know the difference between right and wrong. We have a conscience. You know, we all kind of know, let's be honest, we know what the right thing is, and, you know, generally we, you know, we kind of know. We know when we're wrong. And it really is better to do the right thing and to tell the truth, be honest, etc., etc., and that way you sort of end up bringing heaven into existence versus hell. And people really do bring hell in, you know, into their existence. You know, they do bring it, you know, there's plenty of examples of it. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead now and play Scott's comment. Again, Scott's comment is a response to a comment that Joel had made. So here is Scott.
Hey, Tom. I'm making this for your podcast here. I wish you'd put this on. This is on the topic of virtue signaling. And I heard Joel talking about virtue signaling, and he seems to spit upon it. What a horrible thing to do, virtue signaling. Well, I have a different point of view. Because to my mind, I volunteer and do animal welfare. I work at a shelter. I take care of cats 2 days a week and a home. I do the website. I do the cat caretaking one morning each week, and I do adoption counseling another day. And there are people that come in to help with the shelter's expenses. And do they virtue signal? Yeah, a lot of them do. They do. And you know what? In my opinion, signal away. If you want to come in and do something, like for instance, there are opportunities made for virtue signaling. Joel, look at the shelters in your areas, and or other places actually that want donations, and see if this doesn't ring true. There are many shelters have bricks that you can pay for your name on a brick. That's virtue signaling. Go to parks and see about benches people paid for. That's virtue signaling. I could name you a million examples of people who put their names on things by paying a large amount of money. And that's all they get is their name on it. And it's virtue signaling. And you want to end all that? I disagree. Just on point, I disagree. I think a lot. Now, you may say, well, that's not the right reason for people to give. Fair enough. I'll go along with that. But isn't it better that they at least do give? If you're out there trying to raise money for a really good cause, starving kids, you name the cause, your church, and you're going door to door, you don't allow any virtue signaling. As soon as somebody says, are they going to put my name somewhere? And no, and you have the ability to do that. You're going to say, no, you damn virtue signaler. I don't want your money. I don't believe it. I don't believe anybody who was raising for their cause would do that. So the fact that some company out there does this and it's virtue signaling, I say, big friggin' deal. All right. You're well, Joel, by the way, I'm really rattling your cage here. I realize this because I like you. But come on back and tell me what you think of that. I had to do this. And Tom, if you'd put this on the podcast, that would be great.
Okay, well, thank you, Scott. Virtue signaling. People do it. They do it. Now, I think what Joel was kind of talking about, you know, the virtue signaling. What he was, the aspect of it I think he was really talking about was the kind you see with the, well, with these protesters and what have you that kind of end up making it onto the newscast that fewer and fewer people are actually watching now. You know, and they're sort of out there, you know, maybe with their sign or whatever, and you know, and they're sort of you know, trying to make their point or whatever. Another kind of virtue signaling, because there's different kinds of virtue signaling. Another kind of it is would be the people with their iPhones, and I don't think this happens as much anymore, but it still does. They have their iPhones, and then they make sure they buy the case that has the little hole in it. so that they can flash the Apple logo at people. I don't think that happens as much now as it did when the iPhone was sort of the new and hot thing, and while Steve Jobs was still alive, people were using that as a way to, and by the way, that ties in, because the Apple thing was a form of ideological possession. There really was this, and maybe to a certain extent there still is. I think it's kind of dying off, but there was this sort of cult behavior, kind of around Apple products, cult of Mac, people actually, that's a term actually, you can look it up. And so these people would sort of, flash the thing at each other, and, I'm part of the cult. I'm part of the ideology. And, if you remember, I don't know, it's been years now, there was this video on YouTube, and I think I even played the audio for it. It was kind of funny. So, there was two different voices, a female voice and a male voice, and it was kind of arguing back and forth. That was when the HTC Evo first came out, which I had one of those, versus the iPhone, and they were saying, well, this Evo has such and such features that are so much better than the iPhone, whatever they were, and the female kept, well, I have to have the iPhone. I got to have the iPhone. Got to have the iPhone. Doesn't matter. I got to have the iPhone. I don't care what you say. I've got to have the iPhone. That's ideological possession. But it's also, that one was based on a kind of virtue signaling, that they're part of the cult, part of the ideology, part of the possessed sort of flashing their possession symbols at each other. And people do that. We all kind of end up doing that to a certain extent. Most people would know what I'm talking about. Maybe you didn't do it with the Apple stuff, but we've done it. Because that's in large part, that's what certain brands are about. If the really good brands can end up kind of possessing the market to a certain extent. Harley Davidson was able to do that, although that's kind of slipping away at this point. But Harley Davidson at one point really sort of, it was a, sort of an ideological possession of a large percentage, particularly of the American motorcycle market. And then you had the wars between Ford and the Ford fans and the Chevrolet fans, Ford versus Chevrolet. Sort of ideological cult-like war going on between the two, which I think that's kind of died down to, maybe it still goes on with the pickups, but maybe not as much as it once did. But people making donations so they can get their name in the brick or name on the brick or their that type of thing. And that you could, yes, that's a type of virtue signaling. But there's a problem. There's a real, there's a problem with virtue signaling. And I don't think, I don't think Joel was saying we should, this should be outlawed or whatever. No. It's freedom of speech. Somebody wants to virtue signal, have at it. It's a free country. You can't outlaw it. But the problem with it, and the reason you should think about it, and is it a right thing to do or a wrong thing to do, the reason you should think about it is because if you do something, and it could be the right thing, but if you do the right thing for the wrong reason, you do the right thing, or a thing that's, maybe neutral. Maybe it has a value, maybe it doesn't. you do it for the wrong reason, get a little ego boost, ego charge, you shrink, your character shrinks. You're less of a person if you do something like that for the wrong reason. You actually cause your own character to shrink. Is it on par with? I guess it could be on par with stealing the cheap pen from the bank. Because you're using something like that. Well, I'm giving money, and I'm going to be very public about it. I'm giving money, and you know, I'm such a good person. Look at me. I'm such a good person. I'm giving money. Three cheers for me. And you know, it's even worse if someone sort of responds to that and praises you. And then you get that, you know, kind of elevates your ego even more. Your soul is actually shrinking when that happens. So it's a bad thing. Now, I'm not saying you can't, you know, it's fine to give money. You know, give money, donate time, whatever. Not a problem. Maybe it's a good cause. Maybe it could be a neutral cause. Whatever. The problem is how you relate to it. The problem is, should you be trumpeting it? You know, there's a line in the Bible about praying in your closet. You know, and I'm paraphrasing. I can't quote it. But in other words, don't make a big deal out of it. You know, make a big public spectacle of yourself. Oh, I'm so pious. I'm such a good person. Bad idea. Then if you get ego support for that, you shrink even more. So you have to be very careful how you interact with the world. Because how you interact with the world, how you interact with your, you know, with the environment, with other people, with other people's characters, how you interact with those other people can either elevate you, it can either elevate your soul, or it can cause it to shrivel up and die. And that's simply the stark reality. It's incredibly easy for us to lie to ourselves. It's incredibly easy for us as human beings to twist our perceptions. As I've said before, you know, as human beings, God's given us enough rope to hang ourselves. We can hang ourselves. We can hang ourselves, but it happens when we sort of twist our perception so that we, you know, can drive a wedge between ourselves and our conscience. And when we employ other people to make us feel better about ourselves than we deserve, if you do the right thing, you really shouldn't get a feeling out of it. Per se. And you shouldn't get an, you know, external feeling from, you know, other people praising you for doing the right thing. As I've said many times before, if someone gives you a compliment, if someone gives me a compliment, I say thank you. But I don't let it go to my head. I don't get a feeling out of it. It's dangerous. If you get a feeling out of someone gives me a compliment and I get a feeling out of it, I'm doomed. The wrong side of my ego would become instantly addicted to that, and then it's like crack cocaine. You got to have more and more and more. And the person giving the compliments, all they have to do is just withhold the compliments, or just threaten to withhold the compliments, or even worse, start talking negatively, and just utterly be able to manipulate me to no end. So you have to be very careful how you deal with the world, how you interact with other people. Ideally, you make friends with your conscience. Your conscience isn't some, you know, it's not just some thing that's constructed by your culture. Although it could be that, to a certain extent. But it's not just some thing. If you're really honest and you're really a searching person and you really are searching for some kind of meaning from your existence, if you really are looking for meaning, then the thing to do is to make friends with your conscience. And if you can make friends with your conscience, then, and never do anything to violate it, you know, let your conscience be your guide. You'll know what to do in every situation. Then you don't need all the rules. Then you'll simply know what to do. And be guided automatically, kind of guided on the right path. And if you really make friends with your conscience, where does the path lead? The path leads to heaven. And if you go against that, as previously discussed, you're on the path to hell. And if you don't, you have no idea, and you may have an idea of the living hell that people create for themselves. They really do create hell. As I've said many times, this earth is, I believe it's a halfway house between heaven and hell. So anyhow, I think I'm going to go ahead and bring this to a close. Hope everyone is having a great week, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.